I am lucky and happy to have on the show with us this morning, Franz DeWaal, who is the author of Our Inner Ape. Franz DeWaal is a PhD primatologist. He is world-renowned for his work on the social intelligence of primates, specifically chimpanzees, bonobos, macaws, and capuchins. DeWaal started his career in his native Holland, where he studied biology before moving to the United States in 1981, and he is credited with the discovery of reconciliation in chimpanzees and is the founder of the field of conflict resolution research in animals. Welcome to the show this morning, Franz.
I'm glad to be there.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. And this this new book that you've written, Our Inner Ape, is refreshing in some of the ideas that you pass along regarding chimpanzees and also the lesser known ape bonobos in their capacity for kindness and compassion. So you've done, I think, a wonderful service to us all if we do believe in evolution, that we are not only capable of anger mm-hmm. and a certain assertiveness such as chimpanzees display, but also kindness. So mm-hmm. thank you. I wonder if you could start off this morning by telling us a bit more about your work, about why you decided to become a primatologist, and perhaps a little bit about some of the other books that you've written.
Well, I am a biologist by training, and I worked in the Netherlands on the largest chimpanzee colony in captivity in the world that we have there on an island. And initially, my interest was actually aggressive behavior. Aggression was the main topic for people to study in animals after World War II. And so in the 60s and 70s, everything was focused on aggression. And I was sent to study those chimpanzees, and the first thing I discovered within a year is that after aggression, actually the interesting things happen, is they kiss and embrace, they groom each other, they try to repair the relationships. And I got much more interested in the process of conflict resolution than in the actual aggression, which is, of course, spectacular to see. But people had described that in all sorts of animals already, and so that was not a new thing. So I got interested in peacemaking, and I got also interested in the political side of it all, because all that competition that I saw had to do with power. And so I wrote a book, Chimpanzee Politics, which also reached the U.S. and was actually at some point recommended to the Republican Party by Newt Gingrich. Sort of interesting. I always say that Newt should have recommended peacemaking among primates, which was my other book that came out later.
Right.
But anyway, he did that, and so I wrote about Machiavellian strategies of the chimpanzees and things like that. And later I moved much more in the direction of studying conflict resolution, cooperation, reciprocity. I'm very interested in sort of the economic side of things. It's like, I do you a favor, do you do me a favor back, and things like that. And then I added on the bonobos, which I studied very near where you are in the San Diego Zoo and at the San Diego Wild Animal Park, where they have a beautiful colony. And the bonobos are so totally different from the chimpanzees that I use them as a very nice contrast, because they are female-dominated instead of the chimpanzees, which are male-dominated. They are very sexy. They're sort of hippies, sort of primate hippies. They're peaceful, sexy. They have no warfare that we know of between groups. Actually, there's never been observed lethal aggression among bonobos. There's never been observed a killing among bonobos. And for chimpanzees, we have tons of that kind of stories, both in captivity and in the field. So there's a fundamental difference between those two apes, even though they're both exactly equally close to us. And all the comparisons that you usually hear between humans and apes is between humans and chimpanzees, which I think is very one-sided. It's not necessarily wrong, because chimpanzees are highly relevant for histories of human evolution, but they are only one of the two that we can look at.
Hmm. Franz, I wonder why that is. Why is it that the focus has been on chimpanzees? And maybe you could answer that. And then before we talk about all of these characteristics describe for the audience who maybe give us a bit of an anthropological lesson about our direct relationship to both of these, the chimpanzees and the bonobos. But
Let me start saying we're all primates. So we are primates, monkeys are primates. The primate order includes 200 species. In the primate order, we make a sharp distinction between the hominoids, which are humans and apes, which are we belong to that group, which is very small, which is just the gorilla, the chimpanzee, the bonobo, the orangutan, and us, and the gibbons belong in there as well. It's a very small group. And all the rest is basically monkeys. So a chimpanzee or a bonobo is not a monkey, it's an ape. Now, that very small group to which we belong, within that group, our closest relatives are chimps and bonobos. We are genetically 98.5% identical to chimps and bonobos. Chimps and bonobos are exactly equally close to us, so there is no reason to pay more attention to chimps and to bonobos, but people have done that. And the reason people have done that is two main reasons. One is that the chimpanzee has been known much better and for longer than the bonobo. The bonobo was discovered much later, and there's very few of them in captivity. Actually, the San Diego Zoo probably owns 10% of the world's population in captivity. So there's very few of them in captivity. And the second reason is that the bonobo doesn't fit the evolutionary scenarios that anthropologists have developed. Those scenarios emphasize aggressiveness. We basically got to where we are by killing off everybody else, including the Neanderthals and including maybe other groups of people. And so the story is that human aggressiveness is basically a good thing because that's how we got where we are, and that's why we're so extremely successful, is because we're good hunters and good killers. And the bonobo just doesn't fit in that story, and no one knows what to do with them. And so when you go to anthropological conferences and it is about human evolution, they sort of shake their head when the bonobo comes up because it doesn't fit in their scenarios, even though I always argue you need to have a scenario in which everything can fit, not just your own little worldview, which is that aggression is so important.
So then you've done your part, certainly, to help kind of balance the view, the world view, if you will. Talk about, if you will, you do have a chapter in this book about Machiavelli, or the title of the chapter is Machiavelli, and about power and that power struggle and the roots of that struggle. Perhaps you mentioned aggressive behavior, and you talked about how afterwards there is this these embraces and this time to kind of make up. But I wonder, what do you know, or does anyone know the actual roots of that conflict? I love the Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, who says that the root of all conflict is misunderstanding.
Well, that's a statement.
I think
chimpanzee males, in that sense, are not so different from human males. There's a lot of interest in power. And so it's not just misunderstanding. If one chimpanzee male challenges another one and tries to recruit help and create coalitions, because that's why we speak of politics, is they never do these things alone. They try to create coalitions of supporters to overthrow the established leader and things like that. I don't think there's much misunderstanding among them when that happens. It's basically that there is a strong drive to be at the top of the heap. And I think that same drive I can recognize in humans. And so I would disagree that all of the conflict is just based on misunderstanding. It's based on a desire to have more than somebody else. And chimpanzees have a very strong desire in that regard. And so when they recruit helpers, when one young male starts to challenge the established leader, he needs to become popular with the females because the females may support him. He needs to have certain male friends who will support him. It also means that when he then gets a high-ranking position, he needs to compensate those male friends for, he needs to give them certain privileges, and if he doesn't do that, they withdraw their support, and it becomes very much like a Washington type situation where there's a lot of deal making going on, and that's why chimpanzee politics is so recognizable for us, because it's exactly the same sort of deal making that we do.
So then, if the root of this power struggle and this desire to be the alpha and you say that that's a biological desire for wanting more. Is it, I just have this big question. Is it that we want more because we don't think that there's enough, or we just simply want more than our neighbor or the group?
Initially, in chimpanzees, it's all about sex.
Okay.
So the power is about sex. And so the chimpanzee male who has more power, has the highest ranking position, he will usually have better access to fertile females. And the thinking in biology is, of course, because we always think in terms of reproductive success and natural selection, is that males who had that strong inclination to become the dominant male and as a result had more access to females, those males passed on their genes much more than males who had no desire like that. And so we look at it as a selected characteristic. And that's also why power and sex is interwoven also in human society. So, for example, powerful males are usually considered sexually attractive by women. And actually powerful males, like Henry Kissinger has said, power is an aphrodisiac. So powerful males understand that connection between power and sex. And I think it's a very ancient connection, especially for males, much more so than for females.
Well, it does always seem to come back to sex, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it is, as you say then, it's understandable if it's a biological instinct to reproduce. Mm-hmm. It just helps the theory right along. Mm-hmm. And that transference of sexual desire to power or money or something else, material yeah. gain. Okay, well, you've cleared up so much this morning already. Uh-huh. How about then talking a bit about the bonobos and how they are different than the chimpanzees, how they kind of they look at things differently. They tend to reconcile differently, and rather than making war, they may make love, as suggested.
Yeah, so the bonobos are female-dominated. Now, people always assume that female-dominated means nice and friendly, and females are not always nice and friendly, and actually the female dominance in the bonobo is not entirely friendly. And so when females go after a male, which they sometimes do, they do it collectively because it's not a single female cannot dominate the bonobo male because the bonobo males are larger than females. So when females go after a male, that's not necessarily a pretty sight. So I would say the females are really dominant, aggressively dominant, and then there's an alpha female among them. And among the females themselves, it's to a large degree regulated also by age, which is typical for almost all the apes, and I would say also in human society. Older females tend to dominate younger ones. It's extremely unusual in, for example, chimpanzees or bonobos to have a 25-year-old female who can dominate a 40-year-old. And among males, that's very well possible because a 25-year-old is physically in much better shape. So in males, that does occur because it's much more regulated by fighting and strength and endurance and all of that. But among the females, age is a very important variable. And so when you're older, you tend to be dominant.
So then the females are dominant. And mm-hmm. and how then does this change the issues that come up in a bonobo society, for instance? How do they interact on the whole? How do they resolute if there is conflicts, which I'm sure there are conflicts?
Yeah, there are conflicts. The most intense ones are actually related to the males, because the males do have a hierarchy, and high-ranking males do have more sex with females. So the males do what all males do in the animal world. They compete over access to females. And the most successful males are the sons of the highest-ranking females. So that's interesting. That means that the female hierarchy has an effect on the male hierarchy. And so if you're a son of a high-ranking female, you can be high-ranking among the males. If your mother then starts to get sick or old or dies, you lose that position. So as long as your mother is in good shape, you're going to be in good shape as a male. And the most intense fights that occur are when males start challenging each other and the females get involved. And these high-ranking females, they try to establish their sons as high-ranking males. All the other fights, I think, in bonobos are much less intense and are very quickly resolved with sex. So, for example, if you introduce food to bonobos, like all animals, there's initially competition over the food. But the first thing bonobos do is have sex, and then they share the food. And that's in captivity. In the field, it has been described that if a group of bonobos enters a fruit tree, which is basically a source of attractive food, the first thing they do before they even touch any fruit is have a lot of sex in that tree. And then they start sharing the food. So that's a typical way for bonobos of doing things. And between groups of bonobos, which is in chimpanzees, the most intense fights are between groups, where males of different groups may kill each other in a sort of warfare. In bonobo groups, it has been observed that when the bonobo groups meet, there is initial chasing and stuff going on, so there is initial tension. So they do have territories and they do defend their territories. But very soon, within 15 minutes or so, they may be having sex together between the two groups. They may then start grooming each other. The kids start playing with each other. And before you know it, it looks more like a picnic than like a war. And that's the bonobo way of doing these things.
Well, then I wonder what all of this time and this research that you've done that's brought all of this to light, what can this tell us about ourselves, the human species? What can we learn from these behaviors that perhaps we can transfer to positive gain, to solving some of the bigger issues that we have, bigger than, well, I mean, I guess it does all come down to resources as well. The food resource for the bonobo society. Humans, we have limited resources, and we're constantly vying for those as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a primatologist, I cannot solve your society's problems necessarily. But what I try to do is to broaden the view of human nature instead of having a view like we are inherently competitive, we are inherently individualistic. A lot of the principles of society, sort of, especially American society, are based on the idea that we're out only for ourselves and society as a whole we don't care so much about. I try to counter that by saying, well, we have a long lineage of primates that we descend from that have, indeed, they have very competitive tendencies, and competition over resources is very important. But they also have a level of solidarity among themselves. They have kindness and empathy, and you can observe that. They have conflict resolution mechanisms. And so we have a completely different side of human nature that is often neglected. So I had to think of that when, for example, after Katrina, people were caught in the dome there in New Orleans, and the headlines in the newspaper, they said, we have been left behind like animals. And my first thought was, like, not all animals would necessarily do that, leaving you behind. There's reports, for example, of chimpanzees who have been injured by leopards in the forest in Africa, that the rest of the group slows down for them. They wait for them. They care for their wounds. And so leaving somebody behind is not necessarily the animal way, even though that's the way we like to depict nature as the law of the jungle and so on. But nature's way, at least in social primates, And the same would apply to elephants and dolphins and lots of other cooperative animals, nature's way is not necessarily to leave the unfortunate behind.
That's so wonderful to hear. So there's really probably no homeless chimpanzees in a chimp or bonobos in those societies, would you say? Or if they are...
They have no homes.
Right.
In a way,
so
they're all homeless.
Exactly. They're not, as you said, left behind. Perhaps they may be outcast, I would suppose, for poor behavior.
They may sometimes ostracize. And so, of course, most of the time that doesn't happen. But there are stories, especially of high-ranking males who were bullies. So a high-ranking male, there's sort of two kinds, alpha males and chimpanzees. One is what I call the populist. Is usually a male who has a lot of support and is a very good leader, and he becomes extremely popular, and No one is going to challenge him because the whole group will defend his position. And then when he gets too old and finally he has to, he's going to be removed by a younger male from that position, he just steps a few places down and remains in the group. But there's also males that I would call bullies who have a reign of terror, basically. They become high-ranking and they become aggressive with a lot of individuals. And when their position is taken, it's usually a violent process. And there's a description for chimpanzees in the field, a male named Goblin, who was a clear bully. He ended very badly, and he would have died if a veterinarian had not given him some antibiotics at some point. So he was basically killed by the group. And in captivity, it sometimes happened that kind of males have to be removed from the group, otherwise they will kill them. So the bullies end very badly. They may have a reign of terror, but it doesn't last, I think.
Well, my guest this morning is Franz de Waal, who has written a new book called Our Inner Ape. He's a leading primatologist, and this book tries to explain why we are who we are. And over the break, we were just talking about the fact that you think there's a group called the bonobos?
Either bonobo or bonobos. Yeah, I think there is a group. There's also many big cities. They have a bonobo bar.
Really?
Which is usually a gay bar. Uh-huh. Because bonobos are very popular in the gay community.
Are they very, would you classify them as bi-curious or bisexual?
They're bisexual. Okay. They're not homosexual in the sense that they have an exclusive partnership with same-sex partners. But they have sex with basically everybody. The only combination that is suppressed in the bonobo is the mother-son combination. All other combinations are sort of free-for-all.
So anything aside from mother-son?
Yeah, and the daughters leave the group. So young females leave the group when they reach puberty. And so father-daughter cannot happen because the females are gone by the time that they're adults.
Oh, interesting. What about monogamy, for instance? Is that not something that would ever occur then?
No, they are as promiscuous as any animal. You know, they're totally promiscuous.
So in the animalistic behavior, as we humans like to refer to, as you said, unfortunately, previously, that the victims of Katrina were all put together and left behind. And mm-hmm. we say that, you know, that was a type of animal treatment, where in reality, animals don't even treat each other that way. But in the sense of sexual activity, they are quite animalistic.
Yeah, you could say that. Of course, monogamy is not a human uniqueness thing. You know, there are many birds who are pair bonded, and there are some primates like gibbons who are pair bonded. So the primates are just extremely variable, and so you cannot generalize like we are monogamous and animals are not, because they're perfectly monogamous animals out there, you know.
Hmm. Well, then let's move to talking about fair business in the primate world. And you say that primates have a service economy based on exchange and cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk more about that?
Yeah, the initial studies we did was on tit for tat among animals. Like, for example, one male chimpanzee supports another to become the most powerful male, and he gets in return a lot of benefits, such as sexual privileges or whatever. Or one male chimpanzee or one female chimpanzee grooms another and gets in return. Later in the day, she gets food in return. And so we can measure that statistically. We have done a lot of studies, and there is this kind of reciprocity going on in primate groups. Then we started doing experiments. So most of those were done with capuchin monkeys, which are much smaller than chimpanzees, very smart monkey. We have a sort of laboratory in which they live in a social group, but we can ask them to come out, and we put them in a test chamber where we test them. And then in the chamber, we can put two monkeys side by side and have, for example, a task like they have a heavy tray in front of them. On the tray is food. But the only way to get the food is if you pull together. If you pull alone, you cannot do it as a monkey. The two of them have to pull together. That's how heavy we make the tray. And then you're basically creating cooperative relationships between them, because, of course, they're going to do that. And then we see how they share the food afterwards. And in those experiments, one of the experiments was where we created a situation where only one of the two monkeys would get the food and would have to pay the other one, basically, through the mesh, sharing food with the other one. And that's what they did. They started paying the worker. We created a little economy. You had the CEO who got all the food, and then the worker would get a share of the food, and that's how they created the cooperative relationship. And out of that grew our research on fairness. And in the fairness studies, we create that same sort of inequality between individuals where one of them gets more than another. So let me explain how that works. Is you can do an exchange task with these capuchin monkeys. You give them a little, let's say, a pebble. They have to give the pebble back, and as soon as they give it back, they get a small piece of cucumber from us. That's the exchange. It's very simple. If you do that with two monkeys side by side, and both monkeys get cucumber pieces, they're perfectly happy to do this 25 times in a row. So they're very happy exchangers at that point. Yes. Now, if you give one of them grapes, and grapes are so much better than a piece of cucumber for them, now you give one of them grapes, the other one is still getting the same pieces of cucumber. Now, the one who gets grapes is perfectly happy with this, but the one who gets cucumber now becomes agitated, throws the cucumber out of the cage, throws the pebbles out of the cage, and at some point just doesn't want to do it anymore. So that's interesting. Then you have a food that normally is good, that you would normally always eat as a capuchin monkey, but now that your neighbor is getting grapes, it's not good anymore. So you're starting to compare, and in humans, of course, we call it inequity. This whole process is known as inequity aversion, as we don't like inequity, and it seems that our monkeys don't like inequity. They basically refuse to operate. And so we wrote a paper, Sarah Brosnan, with whom I did the study, and I, we wrote a paper, Monkeys Reject Unequal Pay. So that's sort of the situation.
So I wonder then if you were to change the experiment and start out with grapes and then demote one monkey by changing it to cucumbers, if it, you probably have the same reaction then, I would suppose.
Yeah, that would be a frustration
way
about what they're getting, yeah.
Which, wow, that's so interesting. Yeah. I mean, all of this is just, it's things that I think that we know, we talk about, we make more complicated in society, and we try to understand, understand ourselves, and yet it really can be broken down to some very simple concepts. As you're saying, that there is this idea or this inherent solidarity, there's a lack of individualism, probably more of a community-based society, even in both the chimpanzee and the bonobo mm-hmm. world mm-hmm. and the ape, the larger world of the apes and other animals. The last chapter in your book, you talk about the bipolar ape.
Yeah, that's us. So when I look at the chimpanzees and bonobos, I see sort of two sides of us, because both of them can tell us something about ourselves. The chimpanzees are very clearly about competition and territoriality and power relationships and all of that, and that's undeniable in human society. That's very prominent, and we are actually a very aggressive species at many times, and so we can compare that with the chimpanzee. But we also have very strong cohesive tendencies, solidarity tendencies, an aversion for equity, as we just discussed. All those tendencies exist. And especially when it comes to empathy, I think the bonobo is the most empathic of the apes. And so I can draw comparisons there. And I think humans are basically bipolar apes because we have this enormous range of tendencies. Instead of sort of trying to pinpoint human nature and say human nature is inherently competitive or aggressive, as many people have done, I would say human nature spans all the spectrum from very bad and nasty behavior to a very nice and altruistic and empathic behavior. We have that entire potential, and I can see in our two close relatives that entire potential also.
Well, Franz, this morning you've answered many questions, and I think raised more questions just to further understand ourselves is not so easy and more complicated than than we all would like to think at times. But I do highly recommend this book. It's called Our Inner Ape. And once again, my guest is Franz de Waal. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I wish you a wonderful weekend.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.